Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I am excited for today's guest. It's actually something I had planned out several months ago. I texted Trevor Burian from North Dakota and said, you know, at the end of this year, when you finish up your first year of grazing a big group of stockers and everything, we'll have to chat and see how it went. And when I texted him a couple weeks ago, I found out the very next morning that Brian Alexander on the Ranching Reboot Podcast had a podcast very similar, talking to Trevor about the similar stuff, and I had to laugh. I guess I just missed him, but I figure most all of us will all have conversations that go a little different way. So I had him on anyway, and I really appreciate you, Trevor, joining me, and looking forward to diving into how the last year or two has gone since your big change away from owning cow calf pairs to custom grazing.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, looking forward to diving into it. And I was telling you before, it's a pretty big difference. And my numbers from back then are as ugly as I remember. So
yeah. Well, that's funny, because I feel like most people probably don't know their numbers, and you've seen them. But yeah, you glance back and like, oh yeah, this is why I made that change. Makes sense now. But
you know, I have a daughter, and she misses the calves and calving and stuff. And Bailey and I, my wife Bailey and I, were kind of doing some thinking, like, you know, it might be nice to try the cow calf thing again. But now, after looking back into these numbers, that might be, I don't know about that.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about that too, because maybe there are some things that you did then as far as your enterprise, or as a cow-calf enterprise, that you could probably change to maybe make them look a little better than they did. But we'll get that in a bit. But I was just looking back, and the last time we had you on was episode 101. So that was January 9th of this year. So close to a full year ago now. And people should go back and listen to that episode to kind of get a little more depth on what you did. We talked a lot about the reasons why you changed at that point. But for those who haven't heard it, or just as kind of a brief summary, maybe talk a little brief overview of your ranching journey, the way you started, and the changes you made here over the last couple of years.
Yeah. Name's Trevor Burian, from Western North Dakota. Came back to the ranch that I was born and raised on in 2010, and kind of ran things pretty conventionally. That's how I grew up. And ran things pretty conventionally for up until 2019. I started getting into regenerative agriculture. And we ran cow-calf. And 2019, I put everything into one herd, and because things weren't going well. We were losing a bunch of money, like a lot of money, $100,000 a year, having to supplement from with off-farm income.
So, and a little clarity on that,
not going well.
Was that like an economic loss, or like a true unprofitable loss, or was that like a negative cash flow of $100,000 a year?
So a little bit of both. 2017 and 18, we had a drought, and we just had no grass and feeding hay for, I think, 1 year. I fed it for 8 months from middle of October through middle of May. And that was an actual cash loss of probably over $100,000.
Wow.
And had to eat into some equity and term out a loan. We couldn't, you know, repay our operating loan. So that one hurt a lot. The other, like, $100,000 a year loss, I'm more speaking in ranching for profit terms, looking back, if you're taking everything to account with your opportunity interest on owned cattle. Opportunity interest is like, you own that cattle, own that asset. If you had that asset liquid in your bank account, what kind of return would you be expecting? And so that's with that, like 10% of that. And then if you pay yourself a wage too, that would be including that. So when you take out those things, the numbers don't look as bad. But if you're being, you know, like ranching for profit kind of teaches you, if you're being honest with yourself about your own labor, depreciation, opportunity expense, opportunity interest, opportunity rent, which they're real numbers. Like you need to be accounting for that stuff.
Yeah. Well, probably I don't have a bell like Brian does for every time ranching for profit gets mentioned, but it might get mentioned a few times today with what we talk about. But yeah, that opportunity cost is probably one of the, not the biggest thing that you learn there, but it was definitely a big takeaway for me when I read that book and the idea of really accounting for all of your expenses. And I just, an example I always share when we talk about that is somebody once after a talk I gave, what came up and kind of was talking to me and telling me about his operation and how profitable his cow-calf business was. And, you know, he had paid for equipment, some paid for pasture, a little more pasture he rented, super reasonable from the neighbor. And he can make all his hay on ditch grass and waterway hay from neighbors, doesn't have to pay anything for it. And was telling me how profitable his cow herd was. And once we started talking about opportunity cost of the equity tied in his cattle and and his cattle and then his equipment and the hay that he could sell for fair market price, it was like all of a sudden, yeah, maybe those cows weren't quite so profitable, but they cash flowed. So that's why I kind of had asked you there when you talked about $100,000 loss, was that like a true cash flow, or was that like a true economic loss, or was that a cash flow loss? Because you cannot be profitable and still cash flowing if you've got enough equity kind of carrying you through. And so I appreciate the kind of, yeah, a little more depth on what that meant for you. And sorry to cut you off in the middle of your summary.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah. Sorry. You probably don't remember exactly where you were with that there, but you were kind of sharing what your journey was.
Oh, yep. Yeah. So in 2019, we kind of started getting into regenerative agriculture, just because everything was kind of going backwards. You know, we were making hay on our land and then hauling it and feeding it in a lot. And I would sell some hay too if we had excess hay, and I could just see our land health going backwards. So got into regenerative agriculture. It started making things better by, you know, growing more grass and doing some bale grazing and making our hay fields slowly more productive, but still that we were still bleeding at the end of every year. And we had to make a big change. So January of 2022, we went to Ranching for Profit, and kind of with a pretty good idea that we knew we had to make a big change. And, you know, we're honest with ourselves about our numbers. And then after that, we joined Executive Link, which is RFP alumni program. And we made the decision that we're going to sell the cows and move towards custom grazing. And so that's kind of where we're at now. We've been doing that for a couple of years. First year, 2022, we actually just custom grazed our own cows for the person that bought them. And then this last year, the person that actually bought my cow just sent me 745 steers. And then I had another group from another person of 410 breeding heifers.
Wow.
So we had two groups of custom cattle this year.
Yeah. So that's a great summary. And kind of the thing that I thought would be interesting to talk to Trevor about, because he's got such, you know, this experience with two very different, well, very, they're both grazing enterprises, but very different kind of cost structures between these two enterprises and different financial models. I thought it'd be interesting to try anyway to do some sort of a discussion around the financials and the kind of a gross margin analysis by each enterprise. And I have no idea how this will go over a podcast. So for the listener, if it doesn't make sense, I apologize. But I thought it'd be interesting to kind of just walk through the numbers, and especially like you said, you came there thinking something might have to change. And then you decided afterwards that yes, you did need to make this change. But I'm assuming that that wasn't just a spring of the moment kind of a decision. There was some math and some numbers that went into that decision. And so I guess, what were the things that you did? What were the actual things that you did, I guess, to make that decision? And then maybe we'll walk through the numbers a little bit more specifically.
Things that we did. So our overhead costs. So after we figured out, and we can, like you said, we can give them the specifics, but so our gross margin, which gross margin is your gross product minus direct costs. Mm-hmm. So your gross product is basically your gross revenue. Mm-hmm. So we were making money when you subtract that direct cost from your gross product. I have $137 gross margin per unit. Mm-hmm. So we were making that per cow. But once you figured in our overheads, we were losing, which is wages, fuel, equipment, all that stuff.
Land
We
rent
were
too, right?
Losing land rent, yes. Whether you own the land or not, like you were talking opportunity costs, you need to be able to pay yourself rent. We have a mix of owned land and rented land. And so even if you own it, you need to, because you could just go rent that to your neighbor and get and make that money. So you have to be able to pay that opportunity rent. And then for it to be a scalable business too, if you wanted to go out and rent more land, you would need to be able to pay that rent then. Mm-hmm. So that's just a kind of a measure of a business. And after all that, yeah, $100,000 over in the red once you figured in our overheads.
Yeah.
And so what we did is we sold all of our hang equipment. And then we actually operated like that for a year, even with cow calf. But once you know it, did that right before a drought. And so then we had to buy expensive hay, and that was kind of the nail in the coffin. And then the next step was liquidating the cow herd. And
It's I think Jim Gerrish talks about like 9 years out of 10 you can make, or you can buy hay cheaper than you can make it. And of course you hit it the year you started to buy hay. It sounds like on the drought, when that's that 1 out of 10 years where it's going through the roof and you can't hardly justify the purchase. But that's too bad.
Yeah, that's my luck.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I think you mentioned there somewhere around like $130 gross margin. And so just a little more clarity on that, then that gross margin you talked about is essentially your total revenue or your gross product, subtracting just your direct costs. And those are the expenses that are associated with one unit of production. So for one cow, we need one unit of semen if we're AIing, one vaccine shot, you know, one everything. You totaled up your direct costs and subtracted that from your gross revenue, and we're only left with a little over $100 per cow to cover all of your overheads, your labor, your land, your equipment.
Yep, accurate. And yeah, that was with a $725 per animal feed cost, which is extremely high. Yeah. And that's the number that was killing us. Mm-hmm. And being North Dakota, there's not a lot of people doing it cheaper than that mm-hmm. here. I mean, without off farm income or subsidizing in that number in some way.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So feed obviously then is the big one. And it sounds like, I mean, you were trying kind of regenerative management and grazing management to improve the length of your grazing season and stuff prior to that. Had you been able to reduce, was this the $725, was that the drought year or was that an average year?
Well, this was the drought year, but even that drought year, we only fed for 4 months.
Wow.
Or four and a half months, but hay prices were so high. But there were years, so like that 2017 year when I fed for like 2017-18, when I fed for like 8 months, I'm sure I spent over $1,000 a head in winter feed costs that year.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. 8 months. Gosh. So 240 days. Gosh, that's wild. We're in Minnesota, so we have a similar environment where the feed costs, you know, we're feeding for so many months of the year. Yeah, when you just look at those numbers, that's pretty crazy. So you realize it was $130-something only left, and that was to pay all of your other costs. Did you at that point even consider trying to make changes to that enterprise to stay in it? Or was it pretty clear that there was no way you were going to be able to make that enterprise work in your environment?
Well, we would have had to pretty much get our feed costs down to $300-$400 an animal to be able to make it even close to working. And even that is still pretty iffy. And I just didn't think there was a way at that point to get it down to that number consistently. I mean, open winter, you know, you might be able to hit that, but like last winter, we had snowpack from middle of November through middle of April. So even if you had all the stockpile grass in the world, there was 2 feet of hard drifted snow. And I'm a big advocate of winter grazing and having stockpile grass because that's the cheapest winter feed you can have. But there's, you know, 1 out of 10, 2 out of 10 winters up here in the north where you're going to be feeding probably 4 to 5 months for sure. And last year would have did that. And then we didn't have a drought in 2022 in North Dakota, but pretty much everywhere south of central South Dakota did. And so feed costs or hay prices last year were extremely high. So even with the increase in calf prices, I probably would have last winter, I probably would have been back up around that $1,000 a head winter feed cost. And even with the higher prices, that takes care of a lot of that profit real quick.
Wow. So do you mind, or do you have kind of some of the data on your overheads at that time? Because I'll be curious to compare the overheads to what you are now. What overheads did you have in terms of like what physically overheads were you trying to carry? And then what were the costs associated with those?
Yeah, so our overheads then were so when I put these numbers together, we had already sold the equipment. So our actual overheads before we sold the equipment were probably even higher than this. But our overheads back then were about $160,000. And that's rent, opportunity rent, opportunity interest. That is with $50,000 of wages in there, which were unpaid. You know, I just for num I th that wasn't cash in my pocket, but just for number's sake, I put it in there. And so yeah, that's kind of how it looked then. It was about $160,000, and so probably before we sold the equipment, you're probably looking at $200,000 of overhead, maybe even a little bit more. And yeah, it's pretty ugly.
No, it doesn't for, I guess I'll just mention now, thank you for being willing to share this and come on, because you're not the only one. And I think you probably know that there's a lot of people that have probably pretty similar number, financial structure to what you're describing, but it still takes some courage, I guess, to be willing to
Yeah.
come on and share it.
I'm not ashamed at all because I see it all around me. People don't, you know, every ranch is different, but every ranch is also similar because when you take into account fair labor and fair market value and replacement value and all the opportunity costs, our costs are pretty similar. So when you see people feeding for 5, 6 months, unless they're doing it on scale at like 2, 3,000 head of cattle and can get bulk feed in and just the standard mom pop cow calf our costs are pretty similar. And so I don't feel too bad about these numbers because it's really common in agriculture.
Well, I like even, I don't know, just what you said there about it being every ranch is different, but they're also kind of the same. And it's probably easy to look at the other ranch and say, gosh, well, they've got all this equipment that's paid for, and their family has so much more land and stuff. And it's like, that's where the importance of running your numbers with all the opportunity costs is. That's why it's so important, is it puts everybody on the same playing field. Because you might look at your neighbor and say, they have all this stuff paid for, or they have all this equipment, and they have all these people to do it all, or whatever, and family with off-farm jobs that they don't need to generate all this revenue based off the ranch. And yeah, if you compare your operation to that one, it's like, we're so different. But that's exactly why this is so important, to charge the opportunity cost. It puts everybody on the same playing field, where everybody's accounting for the costs in a fair and appropriate way, so that then they can I guess you can analyze and actually put yourself on a fair playing field. So that was a
Yeah,
good point.
even if they have paid for equipment, you still have to account for the cost of replacing that equipment someday. And so whether you have a 5-year note, bank loan on that tractor, or it's you paid cash for it somehow, it costs the same. With the bank note, you know, if you pay cash for it, you're saving money that you don't have to pay the bank in interest. But the actual sale price for that piece of equipment that you have to replace is the same. So the costs are pretty similar, whether you have it paid for or you're, you know, have debt against it.
No, exactly. Yeah, it's interesting, and I hear people say all the time, well, people can run the numbers in whatever way they want to make it look how they want. And it's kind of true. You can run numbers, but that's why I guess I think this is probably the most fair way to run numbers. And you know, it might not make, I think actually I've heard it many a times, and I've also heard it from people say that they don't want to go to the school for the same reason for many a times, because it forces you to ask the questions. And while it doesn't force you to ask the questions, it gives you the answers to the questions that you maybe don't want to know. That puts you in a tough spot. I know it sure did with us when we got back and started running the numbers. It was like, goodness, man, maybe it would have been a lot less stressful around here had we not known this, but that's what it is.
Yeah, I've thought about that too, and I've had conversations with people that have said the same thing. Yeah, it's really eye-opening when you start being honest with what it costs you to run a cow-calf operation.
Yeah. And then I think it's important to realize too that no one is forcing anybody to actually make changes, but it does give you the information to make the appropriate decisions for yourself. I mean, you're still more than welcome to operate a business in whatever way you see fit. If you're cash flowing, again, the difference between this cash flow and economic profit that we discussed, if you're cash flowing, you're doing what you love, you're accomplishing the goals that you set out to accomplish, and you're happy with that, there is nothing wrong with that. It's just,
yeah, it all comes back to your vision, what you hold in value and what you want to do. If you're passionate, like on your last podcast, you talked a lot about livestock ownership versus, you know, wanting to, you know, that being a true value, or is your value the land?
Yeah.
If your true passion is livestock ownership and your numbers are ugly, okay, let's figure out how to chop off some dead wood and increase your production, figure out how to increase your numbers. Let's work towards that. But you know, for myself, I'm more passionate about the grass side of it. And, and now I wasn't before the making money, part of it. And so if that's your passion, there might be an enterprise that suits you better. So it, and like you said about this, they don't tell you to do anything. They provide you with the information. They can help you put together your numbers a little bit. And if you want feedback on what they think you should do, they'll give it. But if you're like, no, we're dead set on cow calf, we want to make this work, all right, let's figure out what we can do to make that profitable then.
No, exactly. And that's, well, just a good point, because even if you decide that you still want to stay in a certain enterprise, it gives you clarity as to where you stand and where you can make changes, because every operation can make changes. There's nothing that's going to be perfect, and it might not get you to where you may be able to be more profitable in another enterprise that doesn't appeal to you, but you could also probably be more profitable than you currently are in your current enterprise, but you have to have some clarity as to be able to see where to make those changes. But yeah, no.
Yeah, I could go start a plumbing business, but I don't want to.
Yes, yes.
I could go start a profitable plumbing business or different business or different enterprises that I have no interest in and be profitable, but I don't want to do that. So it's just a matter of what you want to do.
That's a great example. Yep. People say it all the time. If there's better places to make money than in agriculture, but at least it gives you some clarity to be able to start to make a little more, make little changes. But yeah. Huh. Cool. So then I guess you realize there's something you got to do different. Did you look at what operations or what enterprises did you look at to possibly switch? I guess was it right to custom grazing or?
Before we dive into what Trevor did to make his operation more profitable, one alternative that a lot of people do if their cow-calf operation isn't profitable is to add value to their calves by direct marketing them to their consumers. And if that's something that you want to do, you're going to need a good online platform for that. And the one that we use and have been using now since 2019, I believe, is Barn to Door. They are fantastic. They work for all of our inventory management. They are our e-commerce platform and allow us to do transactions both online and in person with their new point of sale product. They really are awesome. And on top of that, they have a fantastic training and support program. So I'd really encourage you to check out Barn to Door if that's something you want to try out. You can go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter. And there you can learn a little bit more about the success we've had using Barn to Door. And if you choose to sign up, you'll get access to a free academy session, and that is a $99 value. Again, the website is www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter.
it was kind of right to custom grazing because where we are financially. So we, like I said, we have a mixture of owned and rented land. Our rented land, I rent it from my mom and paying rent to her until she dies. And then we get the land. The land is paid for, but she needs that income to live. And then we also purchased some land, which probably was also the nail in the coffin of our cow herd, because it's land is expensive. Mm-hmm. But we made that decision, and we want to try to make it work. And so this is the kind of direction that we had to go. So we did not think it would, you know, if we moved into like stalkers. First of all, I've never done stalkers, and I really need to go. I might possibly like to move in that direction of owning some of the cattle that we have. I really need to go to the Wally Olson sell by marketing school and really educate myself more on that. And then, so I don't have a lot of knowledge in that. And then also I just did not want the risk of more debt. You know, if we had a disaster, I mean, we would have had our backs up against the wall more than we already did. And so custom grazing seemed like a way, you know, was a way to generate income on our land without any risk as far as debt, and, you know, without just renting out our ground mm-hmm. and having someone else run on it. Like, I'm passionate about grass and land management, and so I wanted to manage my own land. So what's mm-hmm. the most profitable way I can manage my own land and go in that direction, because that's where my kind of passion is.
Yeah. Now that just kind of what you talked about there made me think of a saying I've heard, and I listen to a lot of real estate podcasts and own some rentals. That's kind of always fascinated me. And they talk about the difference between a person owning a rental or owning a home, owning their own home or renting, is that as an owner, you have set your minimum price you will ever have to pay for housing. And that's your mortgage, your property tax, your insurance, but you have this infinite amount of upside risk that could happen. You could have water pipes break, you know, everything could happen and stuff. As opposed to renting, you've set your maximum price, your maximum, exposure to risk. I guess your rent is your max you'll ever have to pay. If anything breaks, you don't have to cover that if you're renting and stuff like that. And so now the mortgage and owning your own home, most years might be lower and you might save money as opposed to renting, but you've limited your upside risk. And this is kind of similar to you. You potentially could have owned your own stockers and had unlimited upside potential as far as income, but you've also opened yourself up to all this risk. As opposed to custom grazing, you've limited your upside potential, similar to like renting a house. You've limited your risk, but you've also taken all that risk off the table and shifted it to the livestock owner, at least most of it. It was just kind of a parallel I was thinking about when you talked about that is you're trading reward for risk, and in a position where you've already leveraged yourself on land, you're kind of getting out of another enterprise, maybe trying something new. It's probably a pretty safe place to start.
Yeah, I agree. And that's kind of why a lot of people that go through Ranching for Profit or kind of going down this journey, that's the first step they take, is kind of going to custom grazers and trying to get themselves into a little bit better position with your debt ratio. And then once you progress down that path and build up some equity and pay down some debt, you can have more options as far as what you want to do with livestock ownership.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. And so when you started running numbers on the custom grazing enterprise, it's almost even hard to compare because it's a totally different model. You have almost no equity outlaid in the business. Your overheads dropped tremendously. Your direct costs dropped tremendously. Talk about, I guess, what you saw.
Yeah. So custom grazing is kind of weird because you essentially have no direct costs. You don't have, you don't have feed or anything. And so these are numbers from this year. This year we grossed $154 an animal. And that's yearlings. We had some yearlings for like 80 days. And one of our groups is from our neighbor. And so we're able to kind of switch out, and they made some good buys with some heifers this winter and fall. And so they were marketing throughout the summer. So we had to bring them in a couple times to take out some cattle, but then they'd replace them with other cattle, with dry cows and stuff. But essentially we more or less had 155 head of cattle through our place this year for about an average of about 135 days. and that came to a gross product or gross margin per unit of $154 an animal. And so that came out to $179,000 of gross revenue. And then, so our overheads now,
So I guess pausing right there
so
for a second.
okay, yep,
Just
sorry.
the no, no problem. The gross margin on one animal there was around $154, as opposed to the gross margin on the cows was around $137. So the actual gross margin per animal was pretty similar between the two of them, which
Yeah,
this is why the
that's kind of.
importance of gross margin and then the overhead is where it'll start to really change. But that's
Yeah,
interesting.
and the reason why this decision was so easy for us, or I guess it wasn't easy. I mean, there was a lot of tears and a lot of, it was a tough decision,
Sure.
but it was just blatant because that year before we went, we had actually taken on what was it? I think close to 100 head of custom grazers, mix of yearlings and some cow calf pairs. In with our own cattle. And so we did have the numbers from custom grazing. And so the gross revenue per animal, gross margin per animal, was about the exact same for running a cow calf pair for 12 months or running a custom grazer for 4 to 5 months. And when you don't run an animal for 12 months, you can run pretty much double the amount of animals. And so just by making that switch, you're like, well, we can double our gross margin, like cattle enterprise gross margin, just by switching enterprises. And it brings our overheads down a little bit, and we don't have to worry about feeding cattle all winter or what the winter weather is going to do. And yeah, and we can kind of adjust our stocking rate based on rainfall too. So it was kind of a no-brainer for us.
And just to, I guess, a little clarity, were those gross margins per animal or per animal unit?
So per animal. So
Okay.
yeah, you're speaking like an AUM, like a 1,000-pound cat.
Yeah.
I think that when you start calculating, it just gets so confusing.
Well,
That's important. That's important. Yes, that is important. Like when you're, because that goes into stocking rate too. Like a bigger animal is going to eat more. So yeah, that is just per animal, not per animal unit. I'm not taking weights
No, no,
of cattle
no problem. I just go ahead.
because our cows at that, they were 1,300, 1,400 pound cows. They're bigger cows, which was another problem, which. Is if we ever got back into it, that's a change, some deadwood we could hack off there running a smaller animal. So that number, the gross margin per unit for a custom grazer would be even higher, or per animal unit, gross margin per animal unit is even higher if you would just take into account the weights. But yeah, I guess just for simplicity
No.
sake, I'm speaking generality,
Yeah.
just for animal.
Well, I just wanted to clarify because
Yeah,
that
that's
makes
good.
the stockers look even better when you consider, call it a 600, a 6 weight getting $150 versus a 1,200 pound cow making $150. Well, you can run twice as many stockers, this to get the same amount of animal. So you're really $300 per animal unit or whatever, as opposed to the 150 and or for the same amount of animal units essentially. And then the fact that you might, like you mentioned, how you were able to reduce all that winter feeding and stuff, that you were able, so you're able to increase, you're able to run significantly more of those. I guess that would be turnover maybe and stuff. Your turnover is significantly higher in that realm.
That's a great point. That I guess makes me feel a little bit better. I guess I hadn't been thinking about it
No, but
that
yeah, it's, I just wanted to clarify because
Yeah, that's good.
that's pretty cool. That is really cool. Sorry. So then I forget where you were going to dive into overheads, and I kind of cut you off at the gross margin there, but.
Yeah, so our overheads haven't changed a whole lot, since because that 1 year when I went, we had already got rid of the equipment. So our overheads haven't changed a whole lot. Wages are actual paid wages now. So $50,000 in wages. I had three guys help on the ranch this summer, or four guys. So that's a mix of four guys. Two guys, pretty much full time from May through October. So $50,000 in wages. between fuel repairs and fence. It came out to about $30,000, and then $60,000 between actual rent and opportunity rent. And so that came to our overheads about $140,000. And so our product gross margin was $179,000. And so subtract that from the $140,000, $39,000 in actual profit,
mm-hmm.
which wow. is, we were about $100,000 away from making any profit before.
Yeah.
And, you know, $39,000, we're not getting rich, but
yes,
it's a huge step for us.
Yeah.
Just, 22, we kind of just broke even, mm-hmm. and that was a huge step. Now seeing actual profit and still seeing areas where there's meat on the bone where we can increase that is so exciting.
Yeah. And I think that just to kind of reiterate this for the listener who maybe hasn't gone through the ranching for profit school and understands all this again is recognizing that before this 39,000, your labor has been paid. You've generated fair market rent for all of your land. You've been paid a return on any equity. If you have a tractor sitting around or whatever, you know, you've already been paid. So that equity has generated a return like it would if it was in the stock market or a rental property or something. You've already been paid for all of those things. And, you know, most people would be happy to be paid anything. You've already been paid for everything. And on top of that, you have a true profit, which is the coolest part about this. That's exciting. And it's not just a $39,000 profit. If you compare to where you were before, it's a $139,000 swing that is really, those are real dollars.
Yeah. Especially if, you know, I think we can, and we've done our projections, and I have that too, if you want to get into that. But if you can consistently do that year after year after year, I mean, if we can do that 10 years and you're talking $100,000 swing in year, I mean, that's $1 million over 10 years. And that is, and you start doing that and that changes your life. That changes your kid's life.
Yeah.
It's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Well, how many people want to bring in the next generation, but you know, and when you're barely scraping by just to hold the place together, working your butt off just to make the payments, you know, now you're talking true profit. Is that's where you can start to, I always like to, I think they talk about it in the ranching for profit school now. It's like, what do you want to do with profit? What would you do if you made $10,000? Well, I might go, you know, I don't know. I might put a little more in the bank for savings for a rainy day. It's like, what would you do if you made $50,000? Well, I might take the family on vacation and buy a new car and upgrade something. It's like, what if you made $200,000? And it's like, yeah, these are the kinds of things where you can start chalking life changing in the moment, you know, and generational changes on the operation and where, or yeah.
And what we're doing with that profit right now is paying down debt.
Yeah.
So that's a nice profit number or a decent profit number, but our cash in the bank, our cash on hand is still really shitty because of our land payments. They eat up a lot of that. So that number looks good, but then if you look at our balance sheet and our debt coverage ratio and the amount of debt we have, it's still very tight.
Yeah,
but we're making it work and projecting forward. We're going to make it work again this year. And I think we have a path. And if we can do this for 5 years, just five years, our equity position will totally change. And then we'll be able to maybe do some more exciting stuff to generate more profit with, you know, by getting that debt paid down, by maybe owning some stockers or, you know, if the cattle market tanks again, buying a cow herd when at the bottom of the cattle cycle and then riding that wave up to where, you know, like it is now. So we're probably talking 10 years down the road to get back to where we are right now in the cattle market. But it just gives you a lot of flexibility to make plays like that. And I mean, let's say you bought a cow herd at the bottom where, you know, you're only getting $800-$900 a calf.
Yeah.
And bred cows were $1,700, and you rode that up to where now a bred younger cow is $3,000, and a steer calf is $1,600, and then you're able to liquidate than at the top of the market. I mean, with a cattle herd that could fit on our place, I mean, that's probably quarter, $500,000 profit potential that we could have if we put ourselves in a position to do that in 5, 10 years.
Well, that's a great point. And I talked about this when I had John Haskell and Wally Olson on a while ago, is you're operating so many different businesses. It seems like we're all just in this ranching business. And that's easy to just say we're ranchers, but you've now outlined multiple different enterprises that you are kind of within. You're in a custom grazing service business, you're in a land ownership business, and you can be, you're not currently, but you could be in a livestock equity ownership business, and you can operate them all independently. And you should kind of look at them all independently to make the best decisions for each of them independently. And I kind of talked about earlier how you can be prof, you can be, you can cash flow and not be profitable. I kind of mentioned that, how you can, if you own all, you have all this equity in an operation that's not being paid for, you can cash flow but not be truly economically profitable. You kind of highlighted how you can actually be profitable and not cash flowing as well. If you have a land ownership entity that's, you know, really no land pays for itself based on the rent, it's an investment that you make with profit, with extra cash flow. And so technically your operation is net profitable, but you may not be cash flowing if your mortgage payments are higher because the operating business isn't responsible for paying mortgages above and beyond the cash rent. That's an individual choice to make an investment above and beyond what you could, you know, what otherwise do. And then there's the third leg that you're kind of addressing there too, of the livestock side, that you can ride equity waves in livestock and sell out on high markets and custom graze your way back down. And you'll find there's, it's really kind of cool because you can make money in all these different ways where you need to be able to look at the numbers.
Yeah, to when you said it's tough to pay for land with pretty much any kind of agriculture operation. And to be clear, we are not only able to make land payments off these operations. I have a oil field business where we do trucking and herbicide applications and reclamation and stuff. And so that kind of is able to carry the load. And purchasing land is an investment, and so that's what we're choosing to do with profits. It is investment from both businesses right now, but one of our goals is to figure out a way to make land payments solely on ranch operations to be profitable enough to make those payments and cash flow those payments from ranch operations. And that can be, a combination thing, custom grazing, we're signing a carbon contract. And then if we decide to get into livestock ownership, that's another piece of that pie. And so we want to develop a business on the ranch side that we can cash flow all of that with operations, which that's the dream, right? Everybody, be able to purchase land just with that. And then that's a lofty goal. I'm not saying we're going to be able to do that, but that is something we're shooting for. And I don't think it's impossible. It's a lofty goal, and I don't know if we can, but I do think it's possible that we could get there.
Well, that is exciting, and there's so many things that go into that then too. I mean, I think we maybe talked about it more in the last time, and we won't dive into it a ton of it, a ton this time probably, but is your management and your grazing and soil health management and improvements that are going to improve stocking rates, and over time, as you build more of a reputation, you'll probably be able to charge a better price for your grazing management and stuff like that, and do it more efficiently to reduce your overhead costs. I mean, there's so many pieces of management that go into improving your business model to where you can get to that. But I just think it's so important to do your numbers in a way that you can actually make decisions based off of. And that's what this conversation is really about, is just being able to run the numbers in a fair and honest way so that you can make the best decisions.
Yeah, and off the grazing management part, we've done all this while being extremely conservative. We're really aggressive when we graze something, we hammer it. But we've probably left. We've had really good rainfall these last couple of years, and even though this is our 5th year kind of doing regenerative grazing, we did not have a lot of soil cover, and so I've really focused on stockpiling a lot of grass and getting all that and trying to cover up our soil surface. So there's a lot of meat on the bone as far as numbers. We need to improve water infrastructure, but I don't think it's out of the question within 5 years that we could have 50 to 100% more cattle, you know, if we're just talking running for four or 5 months. And so, you know, when you start figuring those numbers and what that does to your margins and profit, that's where we're getting, if we can do that, we'll be getting close to being able to cash flow some land payments.
Yeah. Because if you were to increase, let's just say you're able to double your stocking rate over the next 10 years, you've increased your gross product by 100% without, I mean, I don't know, you might have a little more labor involved in that, a little more fence and water infrastructure.
Maybe 25% more, you know, in wages and fence and water infrastructure, but a lot of that is one-time costs.
Yeah.
And then it kind of just goes back over to the labor as far as moving more water and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, our rent is going to stay the same.
Yes.
And so we could, you know, double our revenue while only having a 25, 30% increase in costs.
Yes.
And that's where it gets really exciting.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That is huge. I'm curious, do you feel that as far as your rates right now, are they pretty well market rates? Do you think that that's something you'll be able to ask a higher, you know, higher dollar as you start to hone in your management?
Yeah. So we're at, with one group, well, both groups were going to be this $1.10 a head per day for a yearling that weighs between 600 and 900 pounds time. It leaves here. And then we're bringing in some dry cows. I charge $1.40 a head per day. I could probably get that up a little bit higher, especially if we start getting into winter and I'm able to do some winter grazing for a neighbor, you know, because they're probably paying $3-4 a head a day in feed costs. And so I could charge $2 a day to winter graze if we have an open winter, and it's still saving him at least a dollar a head per day. But I think we're getting decent money for right now. And then so the group from the other cattle owner that sent me 745 steers, because of where the market is and how expensive it is, he wants to buy both heifers and spay them and steers, and wants to run them separate, because even if the heifers are spayed, the steers will still ride them a little bit, I guess. And so he wants to run two groups. And so I said, well, we're going to, you know, that probably 50% increase in my labor and infrastructure costs. And that might have been high. I was kind of just maybe proving the point. And so he offered to pay $1.25 a head per day if we're going to run two separate groups, which is okay. I think it'll also be a good challenge for us, because if some point I wanted to start, you know, owning some of the cattle, I'd probably want to run them separate, maybe. So it'll be a challenge for us running three groups this summer. And so he's going to send 900 head total this year. And so he sent 745 last year. He's sending 900 this year. And then that other group that was 410 last year, they're sending 450. So we're increasing those numbers a little bit. And then, which I think is still being conservative, but which is good, because, you know, in a drought scenario, we'll be fine. We'll be able to run those numbers. And just with those projecting forward, we'll be fine. But that also leaves us room to take in some fall and winter grazers and try to make additional money. If we have a good year and still have grass left by the time those yearlings leave.
Yeah. Yeah. And someday when you get into owning more livestock, I don't know, if it sounds like you listened to my one last week where I kind of asked him what kind of a premium you can get for livestock ownership. And he said he doesn't even consider custom grazing rates anymore based on what he can make owning livestock. And so that'll be exciting someday when you can get to that too. But I'm curious on, we talked a lot about, you know, the benefits. Well, before I move on that, is there anything more on kind of these numbers analysis that we've discussed on between the two that you think is worth sharing?
No. And, you know, we're doing this all on either, you know, rented land, but it's rented but basically owned, because we're not getting rid of it. But, you know, building this business on our land, we have the opportunity to go rent fair market rate or even a little bit above fair market and still be profitable. So there's also meat on the bone there. So Yeah, it's just really exciting. We were in a place where it just felt like everything was closing around us, and we could not see a path forward to make more money without spending a bunch of money, and it was just suffocating. And now to see all the opportunities in front of us is just really exciting.
That's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a huge part of all of this, is that if your goal is to expand and you're cash flowing but not profitable, I mean, you can't scale a business that's being subsidized. Like, that doesn't work. You run out of extra money or whatever to subsidize it on. You might be able to cash flow and operate your business with your paid for land or your off farm job, but at some point you run out of money to spend or to help make it work. And so when the neighboring farm comes up and he offers you to lease 1,000 more acres and take on his cows or whatever, and you're trying to figure out how to make it work, I mean, it doesn't work if your operation doesn't stand alone on, have standalone profit and stuff, where when you have a true net profit, that is a business that you can confidently move forward and say, I've proven this. It cash flows, it profits in and above compensating me for every expense, whether it's a cash expense or not. You can confidently move forward with an expansion project. And that's huge comfort to be able to have that. And that's where I think where a lot of people, I always looked at big farms in my area, it's corn and soybeans. It's like, how do they do that? I would be scared to death. Like, I mean, I would be so stressed and stuff. They probably know their numbers better, a whole lot better than I ever did, that they can confidently offer a certain price point, and maybe not either. But a lot of those guys maybe go broke. But I mean, knowing your numbers gives you confidence to be able to expand. And I've seen it and heard it where people, they expand assuming that the growth is what will take them to the next level of profitability. But if anything, it traps them more, because that expansion comes with debt. And not only do they have the cost of the asset, but they're paying interest on it or whatever, and it sets them back even further. So.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it felt like we were running 1,000 miles an hour with a blindfold on, and now it just feels like we've taken that blindfold off. And because when you get into those situations where it's a tough situation and it's debt, it's not a work ethic issue. Like, we'll all work ourselves to death, and I was working so hard, because it's like, well, just work, 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 and it'll pay off. But it just felt like we've had a blindfold taken off. It's like, okay, it's still tough. It's still going to be tough from a cash flow aspect, but now we can see a path forward. We can see where we're going. We know kind of, what we want to do, what our true values are. And that's as important as anything, is figuring out what's truly important to you. Is it owning livestock? Or is it being, debt free, or whatever your values are? I like the land ownership aspect. I want to make our land, I just want it to be on an ever increasing plane of health. I want it to have a whole bunch of wildlife. I want it to grow a whole bunch of grass. I want it to be great. And that's where my passion lies. And so we're able to own, by doing it this way, we're able to own the land and make it work, where before we were owning the land, owning the cattle, owning the equipment, and it was not working. So yeah, it's just a matter of what you really value. And that's the first step in figuring all this out.
Well, we probably won't touch too much on this last kind of question or topic that I've got for you, but I'm curious. We talked a lot about the numbers. How about the logistics of switching from this cow-calf enterprise? The good and were there any bad? I've always stressed about the idea of bringing stockers in versus my cows, as I know my cows. They're docile, they're calm, they're easy to manage. Bringing in a 700 cattle from who knows where, managed who knows how, with who knows what genetics behind them, that's got some stress probably to it too. So talk a little bit about the actual logistics of managing this different class of animal.
Yeah, so I'll start with last year when we were custom grazing a whole bunch of pairs. That proved difficult just from a logistics standpoint in moving young pairs the first couple months, having, trying to take them a mile or two down the road. We're contiguous enough where we can trail everything, but there's a couple 2-3 mile moves in there to get from chunk of land to chunk of land, and doing that with young calves, it didn't go well. So now moving into that was our struggle last year. Moving into this year, I have a whole bunch of smaller pastures and we run a bunch of poly wire, but a lot of my pastures were fenced with three wire barbed wire fence. And I thought, you know, yearlings would do fine with that, you know, went through, fixed them all up and, you know, they're tight. But especially early in the year when those yearlings are shedding their winter coat, they stick their head through that barbed wire fence and just move it back and forth, scratching it off to get the wire loose and squeeze through. And they realize they can do that. And then they'll do that all summer. So I realized that my three wire barbed wire fences are pretty much ineffective. We ended up having to run an offset hot wire on pretty much everything that we had barbed wire. And so we ended up starting to just tear out all of that and replacing it with single strand high tensile wire. And those steers, after 2-3 days, they trained up to that hot wire and rarely had any problems. They never got out of single wire high tensile. There were times where, you know, they would bust through the poly wire at night storms or whatever. We made a mistake forgetting to hook up electricity to it. But that high tensile fence is a game changer. Because only one wire, smooth wire, you know, that smooth high tensile wire instead of dealing with barbed wire, so much easier to work with. You don't rip up your hands. It costs 10% of the cost, what it costs to build a fence. Your posts are farther apart, like you're only dealing with one wire, so you don't have to build these big bulky H braces. And another thing that we're doing, we don't build any gates anymore, really. We'll just use underpasses. We'll just make a long fence, and then you can put a gate wherever. Sticks of PVC pipe, 8-foot sticks of PVC pipe, undo the clips on the high tensile fence, raise that wire up, cattle can go underneath. So you can put a gate wherever. So that reduces your costs, and gates are always where you're going to have your problems carrying electricity and all that. So it's been a big learning curve as far as what we want to do for our fences. Like I said, I thought they were all pretty much all good, and we're going to kind of be able to chip away at some smaller projects. And the new land we purchased, I fenced it, you know, when we got it, immediately all with single wire high tensile. And kind of got that set up really good. But I realized, you know, our home stuff, the stuff I was born and raised on, I had that fenced in a bunch of smaller pastures with barbed wire. And I realized we pretty much have to tear all that out and start over. Oof. And so we got a big project there that we're chipping away at, where we have to get a few miles of fence up before cattle show up next year. So we got some projects. So that's a big thing, that yearlings just don't respect fences the way that cows do, and cows that are used to your place. And so that's been a big kind of shock.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Wow. Yeah. That would be pretty frustrating if you think you have solid fence and turns out you have miles of fence to build, rebuild. That's even the worst. Building fence isn't that bad. It's tearing down old fence. That's the worst. Barbed wire specifically.
Yeah. Tearing up fence is miserable. It's deflating. It's like you're going backwards.
yes, exactly.
And once it's all tore out and you got a blank, once it's all tore out and you got a blank slate, like you said, it's no problem at all. You can knock it out and it feels like you're actually doing something. But that tearing it out and dealing with that old barbed wire, it's deflating.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, if I'm gonna pick up fresh land, I would almost rather it was undeveloped, unless it's got good fence. I'd rather it was undeveloped as opposed to something like that. But cool, no, that makes sense. That sounds like a big challenge. Otherwise, though, managing the yearlings really went pretty well for you.
Yeah, moving them was easy once they got used to it. I mean, not having to worry about calves and the long moves. I mean, they're a little bit wilder than cows, but I mean, it's nothing compared to when you're moving young pairs and you have 100 calves run back on you, and you got to try to sort that mess out for the next day and a half. The other thing is water. We need to upgrade our water. We're kind of maxed out with our current water infrastructure as far as numbers. So we just need to get more gallons per minute to the end of our lines, whether that's and we've got real creative. We pump out of dams with solar. We pump out of a river with we got an electrical post there. And then we have some well water also. And so basically everywhere we have about 10 gallons per minute. And then we have some rural chunk of land with rural water on it. And they only let 5 gallons per minute come out of it, but we have rural water spigots on either side of the road. So run above ground line through a culvert to tie it together to get to that 10 gallons a minute. And so figuring out how to get enough water to those bigger groups of cattle is a challenge, but we're lucky to have kind of multiple water sources. And I think some areas, if we wanted to increase that, we could replace some of we have a bunch of inch and quarter line, and we do a bunch of above ground line. We pretty much have one water point per chunk of land where it would be good for winter water, where it's buried 6 feet deep. But as far as for our pasture rotations in the summer, it's pretty much all above ground line. Replacing some of that above ground inch and a quarter line and putting in 2 inch would give us some more flow. And then I also want to build like a trailer, just like a bumper pull trailer with some solar panels and a pump on it, where we could just pull that up to a pond, throw that pump in the pond, get another 5 to 10 gallons a minute, tie that into the existing system. That could get us some more gallons per minute if we want to increase our numbers more than they are right now. But as far as this year, especially now that he wants those groups of cattle split up, so it's going to be 600, 300, and 450, we'll be able to make it with the existing water infrastructure. But we are going to, so we have portable tanks that we also use in the summer. We're going to have to purchase a couple extra. We have 1,200 gallon steel tanks from Shane Barber Industries, and I've kind of found the sweet spot number with those is about 300 head per tank. And so last year we were a little bit over that on both groups. So I had 410 cattle watering out of one tank, and that got really tight when the heat of the summer. And so I'm going to put an extra tank out there for the 450, and then for the 300 group, I'll just be able to, well, it depends on how he splits it up. He might do 600, 300, or a mixture. But if we get up to around 400, we're going to have to put another tank out there, and then have two tanks with if there's 600. So yeah, so we're going to have to buy a couple more tanks. So that's expense. But if we want to scale, we're going to have to buy that stuff anyway.
No, that's one that I wish we had done even earlier, and I think a lot of people wish they had done earlier, is build for future animal, what invest in the water infrastructure that you may someday need. Now, if it's clearly you'll never need, it's a small chunk of ground, you'll never get what's around it, you never need something bigger, fine. But that's tough to replace too, just like that barbed wire. So yeah, if you're investing in infrastructure out there, invest in what you might need someday. If you talk about, I mean, you hear a lot of people talking about doubling or tripling stock, stocking density over the years and stuff, or carrying capacity, excuse me. Build for that. Don't build what's cheapest.
I have a friend in southeastern Montana, Ryan Bruski, and they've kind of made similar transition to us, or going through it, and they're running going to be running yearlings, and they are talking about they have a pretty good chunk of land, running 2,000 yearlings in a group, and they're currently developing water for that, and I went and checked it out this summer, where they're talking, they need to get 30 gallons a minute and a couple thousand gallon, 5,000 gallons in storage, and just the scale of the infrastructure that they're putting in, so they can run, is somewhere where I hope to eventually have to go someday too. But it's impressive that kind of numbers they're talking about, and they're doing just that. They're planning for right now and then for the future. Like, so if they have to have 3,000, 4,000, in a group, they'll be able to make it work.
Man, that's awesome. That's so cool. No, that's awesome. Well, That's most of the questions that I had off the top of my head. So this has been a pretty wild ride the last couple of years. Is there anything that, you know, highlights that you think is worth sharing before we wrap up?
I kind of mentioned this on Brian's podcast, but we're with the cattle market, there's probably people even operating, you know, really conventionally that are seeing some profits this year, which is great and much needed, and getting some people back on their feet. But know that the market is gonna come down again.
Yeah.
And there's gonna be droughts and bad winters. And if you had a tough time, you know, making it to this point, what are you using those profits for to make sure that you're not in that same spot? You know, while you're profitable is the easiest time to make changes and start maybe whittling away on some of that dead wood or things you're spending too much money on. So, I would just, everyone out there, just take a good hard look and reflect on, you know, is your profitability a reflection of just the current cattle market, or is it the outcome of a successful, sustainable business that you can actually scale? And so it's an exciting time. I'm super happy for everybody that things are going better, because it was pretty dark for a couple of years there for a lot of people, or pretty much everybody in the cattle business. So start making changes while it's a little bit easier right now.
Now's the time to take a jump on the folks that aren't willing to change, because it's when times are good, it's easy to sit back and say times are good, I don't need to make any changes. But when times are tough, it's hard to make those changes, because every little change, and you know, if something doesn't go quite right, you could be knocked out of business. So take the opportunity now, so that when the times get tough, you're set up to weather the storm and maybe take advantage of some opportunities that come in those times. But that's a great kind of thought. Yeah, it's don't waste good times.
Absolutely.
How can people find you? Where can people find you? You're out there on social media sharing lots of good information. Just point people where they can find more.
I'm on Facebook and TikTok. I post most of my stuff on TikTok, but yeah, you can Hungry Man Butte Ranch on TikTok. If you have questions, it's usually easier to Trevor Byrne on Facebook. Message me, and happy to help. Or if you have further questions or need a direction, or you know, if you're usually when people ask me like grazing questions or something, and you're not from my area, I'll usually try to redirect you to somebody I know in the area that has a little bit more similar context. I'll, you know, give my feedback. But like you, Jared, you operate in an entirely different, you know, we're both northern and it's cold, but beyond that, it's very different. So find me on Facebook, TikTok.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Trevor. This was awesome. I really appreciate you willing to share all the numbers. It's something that I'm always nervous to like ask people about, because you know, for a lot of folks, those numbers are pretty personal, and especially if that doesn't look as good as maybe, you know, something people want to share. So I appreciate your willingness to share it. There's going to be a lot of value gained by people listening to this. I know that. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to do it. Happy to help and just kind of be transparent about, because like you said, it's really a private thing, but everyone's costs are different, but I bet they're pretty close to the same if you operate in similar fashions. And I know that there's a lot of people that operate the way that we used to. And so it's my pleasure to try to help people and maybe see a different path forward if they're struggling.
The Herd Quitter Podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.